Well, welcome to the West Coast Project podcast for Fargo TV. My name is Mike, and I'm here with Michelle. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Mike.
We're into the second episode of this series that seems to be capturing everybody's attention. What did you think of the second episode? Do you have any overall thoughts about it?
Yeah, the first time I watched it, I think I didn't catch as much in it as I did the second time I watched it. The first time I don't know, I didn't think it was maybe as good as the first episode, but the second time I went through it, I think I really caught a whole lot more and got the feel for the character. It could have just been the time I was watching it or something. It was pretty late and I was tired, but I thought it was pretty good. What did you think?
I liked it. I was going to ask you what you caught that you thought that you didn't catch the first viewing.
Oh, well, there's many, many, many things, but just more the nuances and the feelings behind some of the stuff that was going on, some of the characters and stuff. It was, it seemed, I don't know, it was probably just me, because by the time the second watching, it really struck home with me a lot. So I thought it was good.
I think we're being prompted to watch for little clues and nuances that the writer throws in there that are either simple and clever and meaningless or just fun to catch, or they may have a hint to the story and what's going to happen in the end of the story.
Well, yeah. And it's as quickly as we're getting this podcast out, it's kind of hard to catch all that. I get a feeling that we're going to find, because I will go back and watch this again. I really, really like this show, and I get a feeling we're going to find even more stuff that, or I will, that I missed. Or maybe you caught it and we can discuss it out here. But
well, this episode was entitled The Rooster Prince, and it aired April 22nd, just last night. So you're right, we are getting on top of these podcasts pretty quickly. Did you review or research any of the meaning behind the Rooster Prince?
I did. Did you?
Yeah, a little bit. What did you find about it?
Well, it's the story of a prince who rejects his lavish, luxurious lifestyle and in order to live the life of a rooster. And he has to have someone, he has a wise teacher who comes in and kind of leads him back into what he needs to be. The teacher's willing to become a rooster as well and then lead him back into what he needs to be. What did you find?
That's interesting, because I got a little bit of a different take on it. My research tells me that it's an old Jewish parable about a prince who goes insane. And he goes insane and thinks he's a rooster and starts eating gravel off the floor and stuff. And he kind of horrifies all the other people in the royal family. So they find somebody to help him, you know, regain his sanity. And the way that this sage helps him regain his sanity is he also acts like a rooster. So instead of slapping him around and saying, come on, you're a prince, act like a prince, he goes down to the low level of being a rooster like him and acts like him. Then he says, hey, you know, roosters can wear clothes and roosters can be princely and royal. And that's how he brings him back up to his level. And I connected some of that with some of this very cool old music and poetry that we'll hear at the end of this episode, by a guy who kind of goes back to nature and becomes connected with life and nature by essentially releasing himself into being nothing. And it's very poetic, but we'll get to that at the ending. But the title of this episode is The Rooster Prince. Do you want to start by going through what we see in the beginning?
Sure. We start out with the two guys from Fargo. Their names are Mr. Number and Mr. Wrench. We find out that Mr. Wrench is the guy who's hearing impaired, but they are it. We have many scenes in episode 1 and 2 so far of people driving down these desolate looking roads with the cold freezing landscape. And this one starts out the same way. It starts out no different, but the guys pull up at Hess Trucking, which is of course Sam Hess's trucking company. And, they run into Max Gold in there. That's who they're in there looking for, to find out what had happened to Sam, and they're sent from Fargo.
Did you get any theme? Did you get any feeling about this episode from the theme of the music while they were driving in the very first scene?
Not that I can recall specifically. Did you?
Yeah, they had some very jaunty, like, drumming going on as they're driving mm-hmm. through it. And it also was not a bleak Fargo day or Minnesota day. It was a bright, sunny, cheerful looking day. And they had this super jaunty music, like from almost the 50s, like jazzy beat, drumming beats, very up and jazzy.
And I did notice that the sky was really blue in this in place of the overcast and stuff. I wasn't sure if that was of notable, you know, anything to note, but I did notice that.
Yeah, I don't know what it means, but it just seemed to be there for some reason, and it impressed me for some reason.
Yeah, it actually did me too. But they throw stuff into this, like the guy who's hearing impaired wants to know why there's not a library in the town. Just odd little things like that. But I don't know if that's just one of the quirks of the TV show.
Yeah.
Or if it's more than that.
Yeah, that guy's not only deaf, but he's a mute. He's a deaf mute. And why did he make the observation that there's no library in town? And we know that the couple Lester was selling the insurance to, the guy was a librarian. His job was a librarian.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, maybe he was a librarian at a school or something. But I don't know. That's a great point.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to it. I don't know why they made that point, but that's another weird clue that seems to be dropped in there.
Do we know who this Max Gold guy is yet? The guy who's in the trucking company? Because there's something that's obviously shady about this character, right?
Just that he was Sam's friend. That's all I know at this point.
Okay. Because he's kind of feels like taking over the trucking, or, you know, the running maybe of the trucking company. Or he's at least there.
He's in some sort of authority. Yeah, he's in charge of something.
So Max tells them about Malvo. Of course, he doesn't know his name, but he tells him about the Malvo character who came in and essentially threatened Sam. And so he kind of puts them on the trail of Malvo. So then we go to the scene where Lester is at his brother's house. We assume it's like some kind of a wake scene. We see this a couple times in this episode. Chaz says he and Kitty want Lester to stay there with them at least for a few days. And he goes on and on about how he wants them to because Lester's house is such a mess. And you can see this stuff affecting Lester. And then he goes on to say that they were obviously looking for clues and stuff in his house. And then you see, like, worry come up on Lester's face. I think Lester wears his heart on his sleeve, so to speak. He might not be the best poker player. And you can really read the emotion on his face, which I thought was great for the actor.
Yeah, he's very expressive. He is a pretty good actor. Mm-hmm. Even though he's a bad actor in this role, his role is, like, pretty transparent, but he's a great actor.
Right. Did you notice while Lester's sitting there and he's worrying with the wound that's on his hand, the shotgun wound that he's got on his hand, and in the background, Gordo's playing with a big gun?
Yeah.
That was kind of creepy, I thought.
I thought you were going to ask me if I noticed the hot dish. Do you notice that?
The hot dish?
When Lester's brother and him start talking, there's a really hot blonde in the background, and she bends over and kind of shows her butt right as Lester's brother says, "Did you try the hot dish?"
Oh.
And she looks like a really hot dish.
No, I didn't notice that.
Anyway.
Okay.
Watch it again. You're going to want to see that.
I'm making a note. So then we show Lester going back into his own house. Thought it was interesting. He's like, he's almost tiptoeing through his house. It's almost
there's a weird theme of boots and shoes in this episode as well. Did you see that?
Absolutely, I did. I've got it. You know that he's tiptoeing as much as can be tiptoed in boots. And yeah, we see that. We see that at one of the wakes. There's boots. Of course, I guess, you know, it's supposed to be a Minnesota winter. I guess there's a lot of boots, but they do seem to show them a lot. Lester looks down the basement stairs. He sees the blood pooled. And he has a flashback to actually seeing his wife down there. I'm assuming that they showed all that to kind of refresh our memory. I don't think we could have forgotten, but can you think of another reason why they would have?
Yeah, there's a lot of audience service exposition of previous things to keep reminding us of stuff by by these scenes, and also by, I think Molly does a lot of it later on in the episode too. She recounts things that have happened and makes things very clear.
I wonder if that's for people who've maybe missed the first episode, or if it's just to reiterate the story.
I don't know. They don't seem to bog it down much, but it is pretty obviously helping the audience remember things.
Right. Well, then we go to a scene where Molly is at Vern's gravesite. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's more exposition, because we eventually see the three death recaps. Right. Vern, Sam, and Pearl all get little, you know, kind of 30-second tributes. I guess she's just paying honor and tribute to her ex-boss that, you know, he's gone now and she's going to try to do her best to replace him. There is one thing interesting about his grave marker in that his position in life is titled Lawman, Worker, and Father.
And yeah, later on, husband. Yeah.
Yeah, her husband. And and later on, we find out that Colin Hanks describes his role as daddy first and then lawman.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually noted that as well, because it did say on his marker lawman. And I was going to say, would you want that first? Would that be like the first thing to go on your gravestone? And who made that? But a gravestone is not usually up that quickly. And they're still having wakes. And we know by Lester's wound that not a lot of time has passed. And I just thought that was kind of maybe an oversight on that. Anyway, that was just kind of a little pet peeve.
Yeah, but it sets a really good stage for what the difference might be between Molly and Gus Grimley later on, as they both develop as cops.
Well, that's true. That's true. And Molly's face in that, I wasn't sure about her at the beginning, but I really like that actress. I really like what's going on with her. What do you think?
Yeah, she's great.
I mean, she really is. Allison Tolman, I think, and I'm just more and more impressed with her as it goes on. Okay, anyway, then we flash back to Vern's house, and Ida's in a black maternity outfit, and Molly's in the kitchen doing some dishes. So it's after she's been to the gravesite, and it's some kind of like a wake kind of thing, we assume, because there's food out and all that kind of stuff. Ida is talking about... She goes into a story with Molly about one of Vern's first bosses who couldn't tell his shoe from his foot, and about how he got killed from a hailstorm in a parking lot at a Dairy Queen.
Yeah, a lot of foot references, huh? Because wasn't it in the first episode, weren't the kids described as dumber than a dog's foot?
Yeah, and boots and shoes and anyway... Molly wants to know what kind of milkshake. I think they're just making small talk at that point. But I think Ida was saying something important to her. Ida's trying to, in her own kind of bland way, to comfort Molly in that stuff happens.
Or maybe in her amateurish, robotic, but getting better way, she's trying to get every clue from every single thing, even if it doesn't mean anything.
Well, I meant Ida is trying to be comforting to Molly at that point.
Right, but Molly asking about what flavor milkshake doesn't matter, but maybe she's just like reflexively starting to act like a real cop, like, okay, what kind of milkshake? Just for the record, you know, and it won't matter to anything, but she's kind of becoming more efficient as a cop.
That's a good point. So then Molly goes on to talk about when her father got shot, and I think this is the first time we find out that Lou was a cop. In the past, right?
Uh-huh.
We didn't know that before. So he got shot from a routine traffic stop, and he just ends up with a limp, and they caught the guys, and they kind of talk about that kind of stuff too, but I think that was maybe to let us know that when Lou is talking to Molly at the end of the last episode about not wanting her to do that, he has more than maybe just a fatherly concern.
Yeah.
And I thought that was...
He may have escaped the law profession, and now he wanted her to escape this by the same, for the same reasons, probably.
Right, right. And I thought that was a good little, a good way to put that in there. That was interesting to me. And then Bill comes in, who is, we find out, is the new chief. We don't really know that at this point, I don't think. But he comes in, and he's talking to Molly about, he continues to go on and on about that he thinks this is done by vagrants, by hobos, by ruffians, transients, people passing through. He really wants to kind of downplay that it could be anybody in this town. And we really see him at this point as someone who's not very bright. I don't know that they showed it so much in episode one. What did you think?
Well, there is a cutthroat world of regional trucking that we all know is very vicious. he thinks it's anything but what it really probably is, and pulls up all these dumb theories. I think he's just dumb. I don't think he's malicious.
And I don't think so
he
either.
He looked pretty dumb in the first episode too, although probably not as dumb as he's starting to unveil himself in this one.
Yeah, and as we see a little bit later on, not just dumb, but now dumb with some authority, and that's not necessarily a good thing. But this is where Molly tells him that she would like to talk to Lester again. And then Bill goes into the stories about how it couldn't possibly be Lester because Lester can't stand the sight of blood and all this kind of stuff. And Ida kind of takes up for Molly and in a very delicate way and says that Vern would have probably wanted to check up on everything himself. And
yep.
So then we go into Lester. He's at his house still, kind of flashes back to that. And he's walking into the bedroom. He picks up the hairbrush and he pulls a hair out of a hairbrush.
Yeah, he's remembering Ida or whatever. What, not Ida, but what was her name? Pearl. He's remembering Pearl little by little with the hair and smelling her clothes. And
yeah, but did you notice the look on his face as he pulled that hair out of the hairbrush?
Same as when he smelled her.
No, it wasn't.
Well,
no,
it was like remembering, a little hint of remembering, then like a little smirk of evil.
Yeah, there was something really, it was almost like a smile, and but not a fond remembering smile, smirk. That's a great word, and that was very creepy to me.
I think he's frustrated that he has to go through these machinations of like pretending he's grieving. Like he's practicing almost, like, okay, I remember this little piece about her, I'll practice being sad. Like the wail he does, he kind of wail and cries a little bit. That seemed really fake.
I don't know if I think that. I think he's having conflicting emotions, and I think he, even though he's glad to be, part of him's probably glad to be out of that relationship, but I think he probably feels some regret and some remorse and some pain at losing this woman that he was obviously married to for a long, long time. Did you notice the plaque in the background when he's like got his face buried in the sweater and he's wailing and there's a plaque in the background that says everything happens for a reason?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was a neat little prop to have in there. Well, the doorbell rings, and he suddenly stops his wail, stops in mid-wail. So you're right, wail. So you're right, it, or potentially right. Maybe it is just an act, even
potentially
though
potentially right. Holy
yeah,
crap.
Yeah, potential. I don't know. I kind of bought it, though. I bought his sadness. But anyway, Molly and Bill are at the door. And Bill tries to give him an out, kind of plays it off, but Molly really kind of pushes in and wants to have a conversation with him. So we go to commercial and we come back and Lester's at the table with Bill and Molly, and Lester has served them grape juice, and they're sitting there talking about grape juice, and Bill makes a comment that it reminds him of gum that he had as a kid, and he can't remember the name of the gum. I noticed there that Lester's talking about his wife like she's still alive.
Yeah. And yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting about the gum that Lester supposedly is all concussed and he's foggy and can't remember details, but he remembers the brand of gum.
Yeah, and you notice Molly noticing that.
Right.
He can't remember what he said. He kind of plays it off that maybe he said something about something else. What did he say? And that his face was a mess, and maybe someone overheard that as Hess. And
yeah, very lame to everyone, including maybe except for Bill, but everyone in the audience and Molly see right through that.
Right. Well, he's even acting like he didn't remember Sam Hess at all.
He also remembered the spin that the washer or that the dryer or washer was on, and it was on in the spin cycle. Like, how would you even know that?
Yeah, I noticed that too. He says he came home and he heard the spin cycle of the washer.
So he's betraying his foggy head by remembering these very specific things.
Right. Right. And then as they go to leave, because Bill's really kind of pulling Molly out of there. And as they go to leave, Lester calls them. I mean, he says to him, he's like, hey, this was a good woman. She was a good woman. Wonder why he did that. Was that just part of his practicing or?
Yeah. Overemphasizing the, you know, I'm innocent. I wouldn't do this to a good woman. I think it was just heavy handed covering up his tracks.
You don't find anything about Lester to be remorseful or sad in any way.
A little bit, but I think it's over. I think his grief is less than his concern about being caught.
I think definitely his concern of being caught is forefront in his mind. No doubt. But I do think he's having these emotions, and I really see the struggle in him. But it's real interesting to me that you and I are viewing that as differently as we are. But that's good. I think that's a good thing.
We also start to see that this contest of wills is really between Lester and Molly, and that Bill's just there as side, you know, the eye locking in the conversation is really directly between Molly and Lester, and Bill is just kind of a sideshow. Lester doesn't even really look at Bill. His gaze is always focused in on Molly.
Well, I think Molly might also feel an obligation to Vern at this point. Molly really loved Vern, I think, and certainly appreciated him for the person he was. And to have, she wants to find out what happened. And Vern was on his way to talk to Lester and find out the answers that they had just spoken about on the phone prior to Vern getting there. And she wants to find this out. I feel like she feels like she maybe owes that to him.
Yeah, maybe.
So then we go into the scene where Malvo walks into the post office kind of type place in Duluth.
Cavernous post office. The biggest post office I've ever seen. From the front door to the counter was like 20 yards.
I've never seen a post office. That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, the foyer of this post office was a gymnasium. Was huge.
And again, the first thing we see of Malvo are his shoes when he comes in.
He asks for a package, and the guy asks for his name, and he says he don't want to give him his name. And just the interaction he has with these people is, it is brilliant. Brilliant writing.
It's the Anton Chigurh coin flip talk, you know? You're gonna do what I want you to do, no matter what words are said. You know, he's got this force about him that he can convince people to do things.
Well, and it was almost another Gus Grimley.
Yeah.
Almost, without that much threat to it. But it was almost the same kind of interaction that he had with this poor post office guy who's just standing back there. He didn't even know. He's like, how can I give you a package if I don't know your name? And he says, well, get the one that's addressed to Duluth. And he says, well, technically, they're all addressed to Duluth. You're in Duluth.
Right.
And so anyway, they have the conversation, and he ends up finding the package. And inside the package, there's a book, and the book is called American Phoenix. And then there's a wallet. And we find out that he's now going to be a minister. That's his new identity.
His cover, yeah.
Yeah. And so...
Well, the American Phoenix is Stavros Milos, the next person that we're going to see, who's going to be another part of Malvo's next job.
Yeah, the book is called The Stavros Milos Story, American Phoenix. So,
Malvo doesn't waste any time in adopting his new role, because when he leaves the post office, he says, "Have a blessed day."
Oh, I know.
As a minister, as his new minister role.
Yeah, he's like, "I guess I'm a minister." Yeah, it's kind of funny. So then we see Malvo pulling into the Phoenix Farm store. And there's a big display of the books there. This is evidently, well, it's not evidently, this is Stavros Milos' chain, right, of stores?
Yeah, Stavros.
Yeah.
He has a cool office with a window to the meat butchery.
To the butcher, yeah.
Why would you put a window to that? Of all the things you could have a window to in your office, why would you want to see butchering?
I have no idea. No idea, unless it's some kind of an intimidation thing. You get people in there, people are beside you hacking up cow. I don't know. But they're sitting there, and you can see the guys through the glass, just big, huge sides of beef and stuff. And what was that? In the middle of Stavros talking, he had to stop and take some pills. What was that supposed to be?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, he did. He's talking, he kind of... and he stops and he pulls out some pills, and I don't think he really coughed, but he did some kind of... Anyway, I thought that was weird, because they never touched back on it in any way that I saw. So they're talking about a blackmail letter that Stavros has gotten. And Stavros pulls out this piece of paper that has like magazine cutouts of the alphabet formed into words. Kind of juvenile looking, like something, I don't know, it was really weird. And the amount, the paper said, "I know about the money. Pay me $43,613 or I tell the world."
Right.
I mean, how weird is that?
Well, we also meet the fire hydrant. Who's the fire hydrant? The old hockey player, Wally?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wally Semenko. He's a big goon in a red blazer and red pants, I think. Or maybe not pants, but just a big-looking authoritative goon that's his protector, I guess. Security.
Yeah, like his bodyguard or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so he shows him the ransom note, and it is kind of childish looking.
Well, yeah, and then Malvo asks him about the money. He's like, "What does he know about the money?" or something, and Stavros is sort of indignant and says he brought him there to make this stop, not to tell him about his money.
Yeah.
So from that, I think we know there's something going on. We kind of find out about it in a little bit. Stavros' son walks in. Dimitri?
Yeah.
And he just barges in to this meeting. And this is, I think by any accounts, would be considered a pretty serious meeting. And starts telling him a joke. What is it with dim sons?
I don't know, but you can tell it's not the first time that he's done this, barged right in without knocking or caring who is in the room or what the meeting's about. His joke was the most important thing to him. He's a dope.
Yeah.
Pretty clearly another dope.
Yeah. This is the third son of important men that we've seen, and they've shown every one of them to just be dim. So I thought that was kind of weird that we have that again. Stavros says that he thinks that it's his soon-to-be ex-wife. That's who he thinks is behind this. And Malvo asks him to sign his book, which I thought was kind of funny. Stavros says, "What should I sign?" And he says, "To Frank Peterson, thanks for nailing my blackmailer." And then he's like, Just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I don't know.
We also find out that Malvo doesn't watch movies. He kind of, they make a reference to like how black males are handled in movies or something, and he admits he doesn't watch movies. Another little clue maybe, or just a definition of his character. I don't know what it means at this point, but I thought it was pretty interesting. So in between scenes here, we see a commercial for Louis, and Michelle and I are going to do Louis starting on May 5th, but Louis's back at the doctor. And Louis getting really mistreated again in life. But anyway, that show should be pretty funny. Check in with us for that podcast back around or ahead around May 5th when that starts up again. We see a couple other commercials too. Later on, we see another Louis commercial where he's trying to pick up girls and he's kind of falling on his face there. And we also see a 24 commercial. 24 is another one that we might end up doing. It looks interesting, although it might be hard to podcast about 24. But that may be coming up as well.
Yeah. Yeah. 24 is one of my favorites. One of my all time favorites.
But anyway, I think we're back now at the show in the Duluth Police Department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are. Gus Grimley is listening to the story of what happened in the neighboring city. And he's thinking about letting Malvo go that night, because they're telling him to be on the lookout. Of course, he didn't know any of this prior to, and we had quite an extensive discussion on the Gus Grimley Malvo situation in episode one. But this was a really good, it was another really good part of this episode. It shows Gus out playing with his dog, and
I thought he was demoted, or he was like given the job because the dog catcher, animal control, was out sick that day. He was either playing with the dog or he was catching a dog. But it was a beautiful scene. The way I took it, almost, maybe I'm totally wrong, but it was like, even though he got this crappy job where go out and catch a dog and he had a hard time catching him, he finally catches him or gets him. But it was beautiful. It was like a very enjoyable thing. Beautiful scenery, beautiful music during this short little scene. It gave me the take that no matter what Gus Grimley got as a job, life is beautiful to him, and that he exists in this kind of bucolic life. You know, no matter what minimal job he has, he's in a, except for, of course, crossing Malvo's path, but whatever he's doing, he's kind of happy. Anyway.
Yeah. That's interesting. I would definitely need to see that again. But it shows him going home, and then we meet Greta, the daughter that he's talked to. That actress is Joey King. She's about 15 years old, and I knew I'd seen her somewhere. I looked her up. I very recently watched The Conjuring, and she was in The Conjuring. She's been in many things. Cute little girl and really good. She's really good at her job, I think. Her grandmother was in theatrics or something, was a theatrical actor and everything. So I just thought she was, considering that we're supposed to see her in every episode, I thought that might be, you know, I think it's interesting to see her like that.
Yeah, they have a very appealing interaction, father-daughter. It's just, you want things right away. You want things to work out and nothing to interrupt their happy life.
Right. But then we have the odd scene. He goes in, he takes some fast food, and he goes, I guess, to change or something. And he's looking out his window, and he sees the neighbor lady, and she's changing her clothes, and he's kind of struck for a moment, and he stops and he stares, and she notices him staring, and then she disrobes.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably not nothing. Probably, yeah. Has some meeting. The other interesting thing is that on his way into those apartments, Gus goes past a truck or some sort of tank that says Jewish Mitzvah Tank, sharing the faith and resource for anything Jewish, which is the Rooster Prince parable was a Jewish parable. So I don't know if that had anything to do with what this Jewish philosophy and theory or religious tone has to this episode. But there's some sort of a Jewish religious symbol or truck, or I don't even know what they do in it, but it was there in front of the apartment.
Yeah, I did notice that, but I wasn't sure that had any significance or anything either. That's brought up with the Jewish prince, or the Jewish rooster that's, or the Jewish rooster, the rooster prince, I think that could definitely have some kind of, I don't know, I guess we'll see how that.
So what did you think of Gus and Greta's interaction about bullies? Mm-hmm. She says she would stand up to bullies, and he's got a different philosophy.
Well, I don't think he says he wouldn't, but I think he says there's more important things sometimes than standing up for bullies. And hey, this is where he says his number one job is being her dad.
Yep.
And so I think on his gravestone, it might say beloved father and then lawmaker.
Hopefully we won't see that gravestone too
hopefully,
soon.
Hopefully, right. Hopefully we won't. But he does go on, you know, his first job's being her dad. He says, I've got two jobs, because she says, well, it's your job to stop bullies. I thought it was kind of interesting that they did have a meeting, some kind of a thing in her school about bullies that day when he had just had this thoughts about letting Malvo go and everything. I thought it was a little coincidental, but I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if it has anything connected to the main plot, but
right.
So we go to the strip club.
Numbers and Wrench go into the strip club, and they're talking to the strip club. We assume the owner, or certainly the manager, and the stripper who was with Sam Hess when he was killed, and they're wanting some information on who did it. And she, you can tell she's just horrified about that. I wonder what would make them talk to these guys, because these guys don't have, we're assuming, any kind of police credentials or anything like that. So these guys just show up in there and these people are sitting down with them and talking to them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that that is that important, but they share this information about poor Lenny sitting at the bar. Lenny happens to have the misfortune of looking like Malvo, and he's a smartass as well.
Yeah, Lenny getting scared.
Pretty funny that, you know, he makes fun of their drinks, and he makes fun of their being looking like a circus act, and poor Lenny, he's not on a very good path here.
No, he's not, and he shows them his knife, and I think that was Lenny's, well, I think Lenny was in a bad place from the time his name was mentioned, but he certainly didn't help his situation, I don't think.
Yeah, he calls him a dink and a lepton, which are pretty good slapdowns, but they don't serve Lenny very well in the future.
No, Lenny, but you have to be impressed with Lenny. He holds his indignation for quite a long time. They show the car driving with Numbers and Wrench driving out of Bemidji. And they have Lenny in the trunk, and they take him into Hess's Trucking to see if that was the guy. They show him to Max, see if that was the guy that threatened Sam. And, of course, Max says no. And
yeah, some pretty uncomfortable trunk rides in this series. Like, it's got to be awful on a freezing cold day to be in a trunk, either in your underwear only or just even in a suit without a jacket on. You know, it's cold in a trunk.
So there's no heat vents in
the
trunk.
It doesn't look very padded, or, you know, you're riding around in a cold steel box, essentially.
Well, yeah, and you're bound, and then he's got the duct tape over his mouth, and they take it off, and he's still just blasting them until he gets punched in the face, and then he starts talking a little softer, but they don't want to hear that either. They're not. He's a prop to them at this point, and just a problem. So they close the lid down, and
so yeah. we end up at the workout session,
right?
For Helena Stavros's wife,
right? And
Mr. Bronze,
right. The trainer. His name is Don. I don't know if we hear it or not. And
Don Malvo, Chump.
Okay, but she's doing some aerobics, and the trainer's just Bronze. He shakes Malvo's hand. Malvo's he tells her he's there to estimate her husband's net worth on the advice of her attorney.
Right, to get the most out of him for the divorce settlement. Malvo's pretty smart. He's reading the book. He's reading the biography, Stavros, to get the facts, and then he's bouncing them back off Helena to see if they're accurate.
Yeah, maybe to find out what she knows, because we didn't hear anything prior to this, did we, about the 10 million or the 15 million? Everything he said, she's kind of, you know, pointing up, like, keep going. He's worth a lot.
Now we see the goofy son again. God, that guy is a goof. He reminds me of Pee Wee Herman almost. But the impression I got from this goofy Dimitri son, he tells another stupid joke or hears a stupid joke from Malvo. And is that even at 30, he wants what every kid wants. He wants mom and dad to stay together. Wasn't that interesting? It was like, that's what a little five-year-old would want from divorcing parents. But he expresses it at 30 and kind of gives her the childish hug.
Yeah, but I think that it goes back to the fact that he's kind of like a five-year-old. In that a five-year-old might run into an important meeting, and a five-year-old's going to tell his mom, who's divorcing his dad, it's all going to be okay, mom.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He's like a 30-year-old, five-year-old.
But I think Malvo covered that really well, because when he came in, that's the only time I've seen any kind of expression on Malvo's face, maybe, that would indicate that he needed to handle this situation right now, because depending on what that son said to the mom, that could really throw him off. He's not going to be working for her attorney and be in the shop with Stavros.
Right. The son could have exposed that.
Right. So he throws out the joke and totally derails the son saying anything else. And
yeah. So we find out Melville's pretty organized. He's got this sweet cassette suitcase with all the labels on the different cassettes that are recordings of different conversations.
That was creepy.
He's listening to Lester's call to him. But yeah, first of all, creepy that cassettes in 2006, which was really pushing the boundary of like cassettes being way outdated. Maybe a little outdated back then, but he's very organized. Why did you think it was creepy?
Well, creepy because, first of all, it was a suitcase full of many, many different cassettes. We're not talking about just Lester's. There was, what, 20 maybe or more cassettes in there, perfectly labeled, that we're assuming, since he's listening to Lester's cassette, are people discussing murders with him.
Probably. But he's very organized and he keeps all this stuff. Back when it was hard to keep, I mean, it was hard to record a call. You know, here we are on Skype doing it with, you know, as a breeze. But back then it was more tricky to record it and keep it. But we see this interesting interaction between Semenko.
Yeah, he comes in. This is the same Wally guy, right? The guy that was in the blazer and stuff in the office.
Yeah.
And that's the same guy. Okay, yeah. And he comes in and he wants him to get out of town. And that's a little suspicious to me. What did you think?
He's checked Malvo's past.
Okay, first of all, I don't think he's checked Malvo's past. Malvo has a different identity. How could he check his past? I think he just wants him gone. And I think he might want him gone. I think there could be an ulterior motive to want him gone.
You think he's like Gus Fring? He has no past?
No, I know he has a past. But I don't see how this guy who's portrayed as a big doof and just nothing but a burly guy, a muscle guy, would have been able to check Malvo's past.
So do you think he's just jealous of this new connection that Malvo's making with Stavros, you know, Chemenko's boss?
I think
Or is he in cahoots with the wife and the tanning guy?
I think the simplistic answer, and he's certainly portrayed as a simplistic character, would be that he's just jealous and he wants to be the tough guy who handles everything. But I think that it might be more sinister.
They don't give us a final answer on that.
Mm-mm. And it's funny. It's always funny to me when people talk about themselves in third person. And, you know, he's like, Semenko warned you. Do you have anything else to say about that scene? I've never seen a scene like that.
Why? In what way?
Where he's talking to Malvo, and Malvo doesn't speak a word, but he goes and sits on the toilet.
He literally and figuratively kind of shits on this whole visit.
Have we ever seen that in any show ever before?
I don't know. I can't remember specific.
I can't either. And then when Semenko leaves the room, he leaves the door open, which the door is like open to the bathroom, right, straight shot. And Malvo doesn't even, he didn't care.
Yeah. Out to the hallway even.
Yeah, all the way out to the hallway.
So we're back in Bemidji now. Bill is taking over the new chief's office. What'd you think of that?
Oh, I thought it was so sad. And I thought it was so quick. And I thought it was just, it didn't sit well with me.
Yeah, the putting the fish on the wall and putting up, you know, moving stuff around to Bill's preferences over the old chief's preferences.
Well, yeah, and you can see where Vern's stuff had been on the wall, because you know how when something's been on the wall a long time and there's a different color behind it, and you can see all this and the screws and stuff where he's just removed him.
And then they even scraped his name off the door.
Yeah, they're scraping his name, and Molly stands there and looks at that. But this is where Bill tells Molly, pretty much, that he wants Molly on the same page as him, that this is ruffians, and to leave Lester alone.
Right. My final thought on Vern is that he was officially washed away when they scraped his name off the glass on the door. He was like wiped clean of the earth, surface of the earth, you know.
In everything but Molly. Molly's, well, of course, Ida and stuff, but Molly's going to not forget Vern. But it's like everyone else has already, so quickly.
So we see Lester's on the move. He's going into the basement one last time here, and it looks pretty scary as he looks down those stairs. I think it looks scary to him.
I think it does, too. It shows the blood from Pearl going underneath the treadmill. I mean, just it shows it from a weird angle, and it's just, I don't know, it looked like a really lonely, dark place when you see that door open and Lester looked down.
And he wrestles the washing machine away from the wall. And you know, washing machines aren't that heavy. They aren't as heavy as they made it look him when he was struggling to move that washing machine.
Wonder why they did that, to show us that he's weak?
I don't know. I just don't think it was that accurate of a portrayal of somebody moving a washing machine. Anyway, it might have been okay. But he finds the hammer that he's stashed up inside the back of the washing machine. The bloody hammer.
Yeah, where were his clothes? Where was that bag?
Well, some people, I think we missed this in our first podcast, is that Malvo took that bag with him when he left. And when he disappeared.
Well, how would we have done that?
Well, there were no clothes there, implying Lester to the police.
Okay. Implicating
Lester to the police.
But there was no hammer either. And we just found out now that the hammer was hidden by Lester.
Hidden pretty well, though. Do you think they would have looked up inside the washing machine?
No, I do not. Not in that. Who would take the back off of a washing machine in a basement?
Yeah.
I thought that was a good hiding place. But wonder why he did that with the hammer and not just the bag of clothing. You would think there'd be room to stick a couple articles of clothing up in there as well. I don't know. I don't know that Malvo took the clothes.
I don't either, but they weren't there. I mean, if they were there, it would be in big trouble.
And maybe that's something Malvo, along with the tape, still has.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't know. So the next scene, we see Lester moving into Chaz and Kitty's house. He's moving into Gordo's room. He starts unpacking his stuff, and he finds a mason jar full of urine in the closet.
Yeah.
Pulls that out. Then it shows them eating supper. Lester, Chaz, and Gordo, they're on TV trays, and Kitty's like kind of serving.
Sad TV trays. They looked so pitiful sitting there eating those dinners.
Yeah, but they were happy as larks. They were just chowing down on the food in place of sitting around a table and having a conversation. This is where Lester says he's thinking of selling his home, and they all agree it's a good idea. Isn't this soon to be making these decisions? I don't think a lot of time has passed.
Maybe that's a point that he's like, what, he's washing her away. You know, he should be grieving more, but no, he's thinking of selling the house.
That quickly, and he seems happy about it. You know, I'm thinking of selling the house. Just, you know, not I just can't go back there. There's so many memories. There's nothing like that coming out of him. And I would find that very
could
disturbing,
be a clue.
You know?
She hurts his hand, too, when she touches his hand at the TV tray. Mm-hmm. That was kind of obvious for some reason. So then Lester's at the... Not Lester. I keep saying Lester. Lester. Lester goes to the drugstore, and he crosses paths with Molly while he's trying to get wound medicine. He's afraid to tell the pharmacist what the medicine's really for.
Mm-hmm.
And did you notice the medicine was unguent? It's a real throwback to the Fargo movie. That when in the movie she bit the kidnapper's hand, that's the first thing he looked for while she was still even running away in the house. The quiet guy in the movie was looking for unguent.
No, I did not. How did you know what medicine it was? How do you know?
Because he says it on the way out, like, I'm just in here for unguent.
Okay.
I can't even
get
some unguent or whatever. And it made me think of that guy in the Fargo movie.
I thought he said oint.
No, unguent.
So, okay, good. Okay, no, I did not notice that. But that's a nice little nod to the movie, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I wonder if his hand is getting infected and if that's going to be an issue or if he's just being overly paranoid about it and they're bringing that up.
I don't know. It's bothering him. He's, you know, and it doesn't look good when they show it.
No.
You're the nurse. Well, how did that wound look to you?
Well, I don't know how much time's passed, and I don't know that I really looked at it that closely either. I just see him pull off the Band-Aid and it looked like a wound to me, but I'll have to go back and look.
Molly traps him in the pharmacy, but he gets past her pretty quickly. He doesn't want to answer any clues and starts to even say that she's harassing him, which she's kind of taken aback by. She doesn't really suspect Lester yet. She just knows he's not giving her information. I don't think she suspects him as a criminal in this thing. But she's confused why he won't give her information. Do you get that?
She almost pleads with him. She's pleading with him. And she kind of shows her cards at this point and says, basically, you're what we have to go on to find this. And,
yeah.
And she wants to find, she said, with all due respect, I know you lost your wife. I lost my friend. And I really want to get some resolution. And she doesn't really have anywhere else to go to get
right.
that.
I think, again, she's the voice of the audience. She's helping us, and she's reviewing and exposing things that have already occurred to keep everybody kind of in this theme of the story.
But I think prior to that, I viewed her more as more hyper-focused on Lester. And she is still hyper-focused, but I didn't know until she had that interaction with him, that pleading interaction, that... Like you said, I don't think she was at that point viewing him as a suspect in any way. She was just viewing him as a source of information.
Yeah. Well, Bill helped her out by telling her it's just a gang of hobos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when he pulls away, he says, watch your feet now to Molly. Kind of another reference about feet as he kind of mm-hmm. leaves her hurriedly from the pharmacy.
Yeah, and I thought him getting that defensive this soon, it's not like he's had a lot of interaction with these people. He had the Bill and the Molly interaction for just a couple minutes at the table, and then she catches him in there, and she just wants to find out some information. And he is very defensive, very quick.
So we see the diner conversation with Molly and her dad, and that was really a cool interaction, I think. There's more exposition, and Molly tells a little bit more about the case, but then he starts to tell her how she lives in a world of, what, needles and what are
drills or something.
Drills and needles.
Yeah, because he's talking about having her teeth done or something. Remember how he relates it back to when she was 5 and she had surgery on her teeth, and she smells the tutti frutti gas, and she's going to sleep and all this, and...
Right, it's another reference to bubblegum, too. Why did we talk about Hubba Bubba, and now we're talking about Tutti Frutti gum? Or Tutti Frutti, is that a smell, or is that a gum with a smell?
I think it's a taste, right? I mean, Tutti Frutti, it's a flavor, right?
Yeah, but it was also a brand of gum, which struck me as another gum reference.
I don't know.
But he describes the tears of evil and authority, the school teacher in truancy, and then there's one, that's one level. Then there's cops, murder, violence, and general scufflery. And now there's an ultimate top tier of evil, and it's savagery, hatred, and the devil's dead eyes and shark smiles. That was pretty cool.
I thought it really was. I think Lou is the voice of reason, as we know, but he is just really laying it on the line. He's able to see that there's something really savage in this, something really dark, and he doesn't want his little girl to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy playing Lou is a Carradine brother. I can't remember which one, but, you know, the Kung Fu family. He's a Carradine, which is, you know, makes me think he's a kind of a wise philosopher, and he's playing that role in this series as well.
Yeah, and that was, I think he's trying to warn her. It's kind of like that thing we talked about last time. You can't unsee something that you've seen. And he doesn't want her to look at her children someday and not be able to see the good left in the world.
Right. If you don't know what's good, you won't know it when you do see it in your children's faces.
I thought that was a great scene.
It's the opposite of Stavros's family and his kid. His kid is just, you know, seeing crap and evil. And the first guy with the two dopey kids, they were just
Sam Hess.
They were just fighting and, you know, selfish and evil and not really looking for positive, it seems to me. So we see the kind of the end of our friend here, the mistaken guy.
Well, yeah, but first Bill comes into the diner right after they've had this conversation. I did want to bring that up. And he really scolds Molly and he tells her he's taking her off that case. He's done with it because Lester's called him upset.
Well, he takes her off the case and puts her right back on it by having her investigate the guy in the underwear.
Well, right, but he doesn't even think those are connected,
He doesn't know anything, but that's funny that he takes her off it and puts her right back into it by the other angle.
Right. So then we do go to the vast land, and the two guys, Wrench and Numbers, are out there with Lenny.
Yeah, that must be Lake Bemidji. That must be that lake we talked about, the home waters of the Mississippi.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, poor Lenny gets dunked in the lake.
That was dark.
They drill a hole through the frozen lake, and he's just ice fished down through the hole.
Yeah, and he's alive, and he's half alive, and he's trying to tell him, hey guys, wait, please, or something. And
his time is up.
That's the end of him.
So we see a very cool ending to this, and we hear it more than see it. And it's a musical take on a poem read by Eden Abes called Full Moon. And this guy, Eden Abes, was a songwriter and an artist in around the beat era, like the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of a California hippie guy. And he has this really cool poem that he reads through this conclusion of the episode. And it's called Full Moon.
Yeah, it was a creepy thing to hear while they were doing that. I mean, the whole scene was creepy, but didn't you think that was really creepy to hear that?
It wasn't so much creepy to me as a counterpoint, because the scene kind of ends, and he ends the poem with, "Where all men are brothers, bound by law, and all things are crowned with love," which is counterpoint to what we've just seen. It's not so much love. For the most part, it's not. It's like evil. You know, that whole story of darkness and light again, and what's getting bigger and what's getting diminished. But I thought it was a very interesting way to end that episode.
Yeah, but the end of the actual poem is, I am everyone, anyone, no one. So I thought that's kind of what made it creepy, specifically when we're talking about the Anton Chigurh type character that Malvo is.
That he's everywhere and he's unceasing and will be that evil, whatever.
Yeah, everyone, anyone, and no one. Because we kind of talked about how he's no one. So anyway, that's what I took out of it. But
interesting, because the Eden Abez's take, or his point, I think, in his poem was that's good. It's good to just relieve yourself of all the worry and essence of the world and just become one with nature and have nothing. And that's how you'll become happiest.
Yeah, but that's not, I don't know that that's what we're seeing in this series, but
Well, that's what makes it interesting to me. That's his intention. He's just a happy hippie in the California beat era, you know, living like a hippie. Doesn't have anything, but he's happy. And here we're seeing all these people being driven by greed and advantage and, you know, roles like I'm the new police chief or I want money. I'm the king of supermarkets. They're influenced by motivation to have possessions, the opposite of what this guy was expressing in his poem. So it's counterpoint to me. Yeah. I don't think they're meant to match. Like, oh yeah, this is perfect music to match the theme. It's like a counterpoint to the theme.
I think we see that many, many times in the Coen brothers in general, but in this and in this specifically, I think we see a lot of counter. That to me is what makes scenes kind of gives you that hair on the back of your neck feeling to me, because it's like when they're playing happy, skippy 1950 music while somebody's getting their jugular sliced or something. It's just something about that makes it worse. And I think that maybe part of that went along with that, hearing that while that goes on. And it's interesting that they found that and picked that particular poem out. I would be interested in hearing their thoughts, the writer or the producer, whoever came up with that, their thoughts on that.
Yeah, Noah Hawley was the writer. They did that in Breaking Bad, too. Remember when Walt had everybody killed in 2 minutes? They played that real jaunty, upbeat music.
That's the worst to me. Something about that. It's one of those you can't unsee that, and it's just, it causes my flesh to crawl. There's something about that.
So that was it for the Rooster Prince. Next week is a muddy road. Do you have any last thoughts?
I'm looking forward to next week. I can't wait for it.
All right, I'll talk to you then.
Okay, Mike.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
To live in an old shack by the sea. And breathe the sweet salt air. To live with the dawn. Dusk, the new moon and the full moon, the tides, the wind, and the rain, to surf and comb the beach and gather seashells and driftwood and know the thrill of loneliness. Lose all sense of time and be free. To hike over the island to the village and visit the marketplace and enjoy the music and the food and the people and do a little trading and see the great ships come and go and man have me a ball. And in the evening, when the sky is on fire, heaven and earth become my great open cathedral, where all men are brothers, where all things are bound by law and crowned with love. Poor, alone, and happy, I walk by the surf and make a fire on the beach. Darkness covers the face of the deep. Lie down in the wild grass and dream the dream that the dreamers dream. I am the wind, the sea, the evening star. I am everyone, anyone, no one.